bisexuality.
Bisexual.
I'm bisexual.
Bisexual.
Triple bypass.
Bisexual.
Bisexual.
Bisexuality.
I'm bisexual.
Bisexuality.
The best of both worlds.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass.
Triple bypass on Joy 94.9.
Triple Bypass acknowledges that we broadcast from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past, present and emerging, and to any Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander people who are listening today. We acknowledge that this land was never ceded, no treaty was ever signed, and that it always was and always will be Aboriginal land.
Hey friends, Ruby here. Happy bye week, everyone. And for this episode of Triple Bypass, we'll be joined by Nick Henderson from the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives to talk about the bi plus history being preserved there, plus find out more about the first openly bisexual rugby player as we bring you the latest news, conversations, updates, and many, many bad puns from the biosphere. All that and more coming up on the show that puts the B in LGBTIQA+. It's Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. And now, here's Peter Allen with Bi-Coastal. That was Peter Allen with Bi-Coastal, and this is Triple Bypass, your weekly bisexual plus radio takeover. I'm Ruby.
And I'm Alex.
And we're here to bring you your weekly fix of bi-plus community goodness. This is a special episode, dear listeners, because this week is Bi-Awareness Week, and tomorrow is Celebrate Bisexuality Day.
Woo!
Well, it will be when you hear this.
We are still broadcasting to you from our home, dear listeners, so there's a bit of time twisting going on, and while you can't text in, you can definitely engage with us through our social media networks. Join in and follow us on Facebook, Triple Bypass, on Instagram, Triple Bypass Joy, or email anytime at triplebypass@joy.org.au.
Yeah, let us know how you're spending Bi-Awareness Week and how you're celebrating Celebrate Bisexuality Day. How are you going, Alex? We're here in Victoria, in Melbourne. We're still in lockdown. Are you finding some new things to do?
I am. As of Sunday evening at midnight, we are now permitted to socialise outdoors for up to 2 hours with other person, which is a big coup. I have this week purchased online a number of items from BW to turn the nature strip outside my house into a portable bar for me and one other person to socially distance. So I am feeling good about the sunshine, I'm feeling good about my nature strip, and I'm feeling good about being able to see people and it being a legal thing that I can do. Very exciting.
It really is, right? Like, firstly, I'm looking forward to the invite and seeing the bar. Secondly, I am excited because it used to be that we could catch up with one person to exercise. And so, like, doing laps with your friends around the block, just having to keep moving and everything, isn't quite the same as being able to sit and have a snack and or drink.
Indeed.
And I think, it's spring here in Australia, and having the sun back is so nice.
It's beautiful.
It's really good. It's doing I'm still as pale as I always will be because I don't like the sun on my actual skin, but I like to see it.
I don't like to touch it, but I like to see it.
I'm a voyeur. I'm a sun voyeur.
I am loving the sun. I feel like a solar panel at the moment. It's very much recharging me.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that. We need a bit of recharging. It's been quite an intense winter here in Melbourne. But it's all coming out again. Spring is springing. There are flowers. There's a lot of bisexuals and pansexuals and polysexuals and omnisexuals starting to feel themselves as the bi month starts to take hold. It's good stuff.
I know the bi gods, goddesses, deities above us are looking down on us and giving us some joy. It's very exciting.
They're just giving us the finger guns from the heavens.
The bi finger guns. They are very much bisexual.
Of course, it's the Bible, not the straight ball. All right, and on that note, it's time for the latest Bi-Plus community news.
What's the news?
Levy Davis has become the first professional rugby player in the UK and potentially anywhere to come out as bisexual after he came out to his friends via a WhatsApp message in their group chat. The ex-Bath and England player's message was short and sweet. Hi, guys. I just want to tell you something that's been eating away at me for 4 years now. I want to be open and honest with you boys as friends and teammates. I'm bisexual. It's something I've known since I was 18.
None of you lot are on my radar, so it's okay. In an interview with the Daily Mail, Levy said that he was worried about this last flourish, the idea that his teammates might think he had been eyeing them up in the dressing room, or would do so in the future. The Bath players were wholly supportive and understanding, despite their initial shock, and after telling his friends, Levy decided to go public with his interview with Daily Mail, believing that it was important for people to be themselves within rugby. He went on to say, "Thankfully, we can now discuss mental health more openly. And in the same way, I want people to feel that they can be who they are and that it's okay to be who they are. Hiding who you are can kill you and has killed people." He didn't expect to be ribbed much by rival fans, and he said he'd laugh if they tried it. And if opponents tried to needle him, he'll rise above it. He said he'd feel more sorry for them than for himself.
In the months leading up to his decision to tell his teammates about his bisexuality, Levy described himself as tormented by his secret. His behaviour and mental health deteriorated, and he was supported by the Bath Rugby Club. Beset by what he described as internalised shame, he had begun drinking heavily. He says he was in denial. Since first realising at the age of 18 that he was attracted to both men and women, Levy has had one or two girlfriends and some sexual encounters or interactions, as he prefers to describe them, with men. The latter left him upset, and in order to suppress how he felt, he overcompensated by sleeping with a section of women. "I felt I needed to be this macho man, which I still am, but I felt like I needed to reinforce this more," he said. "I feel that if I were to be in a relationship with a woman, then people would say, oh, he's not bisexual," he says. "At the time, the woman might think that as a bisexual, my focus is not going to be on her. And if I were in a relationship with a man, people would think, he's not bi, he's gay. Yet none of this is true. I think I'm attracted to the person, not the gender." Well, he sums it up really beautifully. His message to anyone else in a similar position and on the verge of telling people, just pull off the plaster and do it. Woo! And this is the time to do it. Bye, celebrations! "There are definitely others out there in rugby at this moment in time. I feel so free. I am really, really happy that this is coming out and I can be myself."
Oh, it's just really lovely. Especially, I think, having this really frank discussion around like masculinity and bisexuality, and this guy who is like, he's a rugby player, he's a big guy, and he's talked a bit about like, he is a macho man and he's like one of the lads, as they call them in the UK. one of the lads. But I was thinking how it's interesting because in Australia, it's only the rugby league that's had a player come out as well as gay. So rugby apparently is pretty good as far as team camaraderie in that way.
Interesting. Like, I guess when you look at rugby and the way the game works and the way the players are built, there would be this assumed, I guess, macho masculinity, as he kind of alludes to in what he said. But there seems to be a culture in rugby and also in soccer, I think, more so around talking about this a little bit more. What I love that he didn't just stop at saying, "Hi, I'm bi, deal with it." As we've seen, I guess, from a lot of people in sports and in celebrity, he went on to really explain his journey and make it quite real for the everyday person, I think. Yeah. And also make it pretty easy to understand for those around him who may be confused or potentially upset by him coming out as bi.
He broke it down really beautifully, I think. And as well, he was talking about how I thought it was really great that he was mentioning, and it's great in general, that we can have a lot more open discussions around mental health and acknowledge the harm that can come from having to stay in the closet or having to hide parts of yourself. Our next bit of news is about the Stand By Us conference. We had some of the organisers on a few shows ago. You can check out the podcast for that. But BIPOS organisations across Australia and New Zealand have collaborated to create the Stand By Us conference for the first time ever. There have been 37 free events, both in person, where it's legal, and online. And this is all part of a week-long celebration for Bi Visibility Day, a.k.a. Celebrate Bisexuality Day, a.k.a. tomorrow. The opening event was a discussion with Shiri Esmier, the author of Bi Notes for Bisexual Revolution, and the person who is solely responsible for, well, not solely, but very responsible for my own obnoxious levels of bisexual activism. So thank you, Shiri. The conference was created in order to celebrate community, visibility, and expression across Australia and New Zealand and beyond, with online workshops, panels, art performances, discussions, groups. There is a stream party tomorrow.
Yeah, there's a dinner tomorrow night.
Yeah, exactly. So you can still check that out. And there's one day to go. So if you're listening to this on the radio, but if you're listening to this later, don't worry. Many of the workshop's performances have been recorded and will be available later. So if you just go to standbyus.com, that's standbyus.com for more info. It's very exciting. We hope that you can find some ways to celebrate wherever you are, because you're worth celebrating, as is bisexuality and pansexuality and
omnisexuality. Absolutely. Get it done.
All right. We'll be right back after these community messages. Next up is Brendan McLean's Fighting For. Stay tuned. This is Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. That was Brendan McLean's Fighting For. I'm Ruby.
I'm Alex.
And you're back on Triple Bypass, the show that's here to put the B in LGBTIQA+, plus a P for pansexual and polysexual, and O for omnisexual, a Q for queer and questioning, and an E for everybody else, because I am not a gatekeeper, and none of us are, and nor will we ever be.
Absolutely not. It is bi-week, mightiest of weeks, and on this special bi-week, bi-day, bi-time episode, we're joined by curator and archivist Nick Henderson, the volunteer collection manager at the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, or otherwise known as ALGAR.
In his professional life, Nick is a curator at the National Film and Sound Archive and has worked in curation and archivist roles across the nation and in different state cultural institutions for over 20 years. He is passionate about collecting, preserving, and sharing the breadth and diversity of Australia's LGBTIQA+ history. Welcome, Nick.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for being here. It's very exciting. I think history in the queer community is always something that is, I think, misunderstood, maybe, as far as our ability to look back. We're going to get into that later. I'm already getting a bit too philosophical. It's what I get from recording at home, where wine is within reach. Now, Nick, how did you get started as an archivist and as a curator? It's clearly a passion of yours.
It is, absolutely, and kind of an all-abiding passion. I think all of my life, my work life, my in-between life, my evenings all seem to get filled up with it. I guess I always had a passion for history, even from when I was very young, you know, reading, you know, books about history and different things. But I guess when I went to university, I was really passionate about art and science and got into art history, and eventually through a rather circuitous route kind of found myself working in cultural institutions. And one of the great things about the various national cultural institutions is that you're kind of presented with this wealth of material, of objects and material culture. And I guess I initially came across the Lesbian and Gay Archives through a newspaper article, and I set up a queer history group in Canberra, and eventually moved down to Melbourne and got involved in the archives, and it seems like I've never left. So it is absolutely a passion, and there's so much to explore and to engage with. So.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, for those who maybe don't know so much about ALGAR, can you give us a bit of a history on the Australian Lesbian Gay Archives and give us a bit of an update, I guess, as where we're at the moment with the developments for the archives?
Absolutely. And what I would say up front is, even though our name sounds fairly prescriptive and talking about lesbian and gay, I guess when we started, which was in 1978, we were initially termed, or we were described as the Australian Gay Archives. And at the time, the word gay had a much broader meaning, in the way that we kind of often use queer now, in a kind of an umbrella sense. And ever since we were started, which was essentially as a movement archive, as a way to document a kind of a broad political movement, we've always collected well beyond any kind of definitional boundaries of what could be construed as being, you know, gay male or gay female in different times. So we've always collected bisexual material, trans material, and really everything in between. So part of, I guess, that trajectory from our beginning as a movement archive has also been expanding the concept of what archives can be, about the material that we collect, well beyond that kind of political movement, into everyday life and experience, from oral history interviews to badges to dildo molds to leather jackets to pretty much anything you can possibly think of.
History that was not being validated around us, and often how a lot of historical texts have really straight-washed, you know, queer people throughout history. What is it particularly that you think we gain from having these tangible, visible signs that of our own existence and of these movements that we've been part of and of our lives and how they've changed since 1978 and earlier.
I guess it's telling the truth. It's telling a history and also multiple perspectives on that history. I mean, often whether or not it's the historians or people themselves have often self-censored those histories. They've cleaned them up for a often imaginary public. You know, you get stories of particular, you know, often prominent individuals. You know, you could say somebody like, say, Patrick White, Nobel laureate, and gay man, and who was, you know, well known for having, you know, I guess within both within the camp community, gay community, and within a broader public for having a long-term male partner. But for him, you know, he thought that his archives and what represented him should only be the published word, should only be that kind of public, you know, the written, the published version of that, not his private life.
So
and he made various kind of...
A curator.
Yeah,
so curation
very much so.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I was also thinking of how Leonardo da Vinci and how his assistant had, like, you know, drawn, like, little walking dicks in the corner of one of his books, and there was all these kind of drawings around to suggest that he was definitely a big fan of other people's penises. And how that's a weird way of saying it, isn't it? But how, like, that's obviously not something that's talked about in history, much like, you know, the guy who did the Sistine Chapel. Oh, my history teacher.
Michelangelo.
Yeah, and his clear
but even, you know, last
knowledge of the female form in general.
Well, last week we were even talking about William Shakespeare, someone that historians and researchers are now saying was clearly bisexual after looking into so many of the sonnets that he wrote in terms of his relationships with men and women. That's not something that was necessarily documented as archival history, but it's now something that we're learning from, I guess, as you say, a cleaned up version of what happened.
Yeah, and I think it's also, I mean, one of the things that I think it's important to reference also is that when we look back and when we talk about different periods of time, we're also talking about different kind of world views and world concepts. And, you know, talking about, it's not possible to project back our current definitions and interpretations of political identities in a contemporary, you know, particularly in a post-gay liberation sense, you know, back into the early part of this last century, even more also previous to that. Our notions of how we talk about different periods and how we talk about identities are very much formed in their moment in time, and it is quite hard to be able to project back further, you know, our notion of what we might think of as being homosexual in terms of a sexual act as opposed to gay or camp, you know, gay in a political concept. And so, you know, part of, I think, this discussion about kind of historicizing aspects of sexuality and identity is looking at it within the context of the politics and the moment in time. And I think often people want to ascribe a similar identity to, say, somebody like Michelangelo or somebody like Da Vinci in particular periods. But it is often quite different. And those are important distinctions to make, as well as seeing them as antecedents of our.
Of course, but don't you also think that that there has been that projection of maybe of the sensibilities of the time when it was, when looking at history, which is why there has been a kind of quite a strong assumption of heteronormativity, because that was the political and moral beliefs of the time. So the lens we view history through is always throughout the lenses of the beliefs we carry at the time. It's just that matter of how much that can be unpicked and how much it's already distorted our history.
Absolutely. And I think it's very easy to get that sense of different periods of time as well from the distance that we have, thinking about Victorian era as being moralizing, but also, you know, opening up the potential for the sorts of the kind of birth of what we could consider a kind of a gay movement in Germany and looking at the, you know, different aspects of what was happening in Britain in the late 19th century, looking at that kind of emergence of sexology, and that we can see that there's this kind of different forms of identity happening at this period.
Well, we're going to get really stuck into this, especially around bi-identity and its history in Australia, but that's going to be happening after these community messages and a song that you chose for us, Nick, which is Tom Robinson Band with Power in the Darkness. Why did you choose this one for us?
Okay, look, Tom Robinson, in addition to being a bisexual man, I guess is mostly known for his, I get the track Glad to Be Gay, which is, you know, amongst other things, was one of the tracks that was played during the first Mardi Gras as they walked down the street. He was somebody who, I guess, identified as gay for much of his life, but used that term in a kind of very broad context. And so he kind of used it in a kind of, in the way that we would queer now. And I think it's important to kind of see him as, you know, quite a significant figure and activist in his own right. I guess I became acquainted with his work through listening to archival recordings of Gay Waves, which was a program that ran for many years on 2SER in Sydney.
Oh, amazing. Well, this is Power in the Darkness. Stay tuned. This is Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9.
Where will you be when they come? They will not come a mob rolling through the streets, but quickly and quietly move into our homes to remove the evil, the queerness, the faggotry from their midst. They will not come clothed in brown and swastikas or bearing chests heavy with gleaming crosses. The time and need for such ruses are over. They will come in business suits to buy your homes and bring bodies to fill your jobs. They will come in robes to rehabilitate and white coats to subjugate. And where will you be when they come? Where will we all be when they come? And they will come. They will come because we are defined as opposite, perverse, and we are perverse. Every time we watched a queer hassled in the streets and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we lied about the boyfriend or girlfriend at coffee break, it was an act of perversion. Every time we heard, "I don't mind gays, but why must they be blatant?" and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let a lesbian mother lose her child and did not fill the courtrooms, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straights make out in our bars while we couldn't touch because of the laws, it was an act of perversion. Every time we put on the proper clothes to go to a family wedding and left our lovers at home, it was an act of perversion. Every time we heard, "Who I go to bed with is my personal choice, it's personal, not political," and said nothing, it was an act of perversion. Every time we let straight relatives bury our dead and push our lovers away, it was an act of perversion. And they will come for the perverts. And it won't matter if you're homosexual, not a faggot, lesbian, not a dyke, gay, not queer. It won't matter if you own your own business, have a good job, or an SSI. It won't matter if you're Black, Chicano, Native American, Asian, or white. It won't matter if you're from New York or Los Angeles, Galveston or Sioux Falls. It won't matter if you're butch or femme, not into roles, monogamous, non-monogamous. It won't matter if you're Catholic, Baptist, atheist, Jewish or MCC. They will come. They will come to the cities and to the land, to your front rooms and in your closets. They will come for the perverts. And where will you be when they come?
That was Pat Parker presenting the poem "Where Will You Be When They Come" at the 1979 National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights. And before that, you heard "Power in the Darkness" by Tom Robinson. And you're back on Triple Bypass, where the bypass babes have taken over the airwaves. I'm Ruby.
And I'm Alex.
And we're talking with curator and archivist Nick Henderson about his work with the Australian Lesbian and Gay Archives, ALGA, and we're about to talk about the Bi Plus history he's uncovered.
Speaking of Bi Plus history, did you know that every episode of Triple Bypass, as well as the Bi Polycast and exclusive interviews with local and international bicons, are available in podcast form on Apple Podcasts, Podbean, or wherever you consume your tastiest podcasts? That's 4 years worth of Bi Plus goodness in podcast form.
Please do not hold the early episodes against me. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just about to in the woods.
You can hold the last 3 months against me. That's fine.
You can also contact me, Amelia, Alex, at any time by emailing triplebypass@joy.org.au. We always love to hear from you.
Yes.
And Nick, we're interested to hear more from you as well. So before the break, we were talking a bit about what you do as the archives and how the archives started in the 70s and why they're preserving our history. And I suppose I want to know a bit more about how has finding out about this history and really touching it and cataloguing all these tangible parts, whether it's, I think you said, dildo molds and leather jackets and magazines and zines and oral histories, how has it affected your own sense of identity and your own connection with your queerness and your sexuality?
That's a really interesting question, not one I was expecting. It is really interesting to have the opportunity to be presented with and challenged by material that you're working through. It is a really intimate experience to go through somebody's personal papers, and it's a really intimate experience to do an oral history interview with somebody, which we often do later in life, and to get that documentation and experience that they've had firsthand, and to get a sense of your antecedents, history, that things that you can attach to and identify with. And it is really interesting to see the kind of connections that you can make and where you can go and find connections and kinship and network through time. And so for me, I've made the most amazing connections with people, and I have, friends from their 90s down to the teens, and working with collections from, groups like, say, the Radical Fairies or the Sisters of Perpetual Indulgence, bisexual activists and trans activists, people who were in Lay Girls in the 60s or were in Girlesque in the 90s, and all these different communities that I feel in some way part of, because I've been able to interact with all of these wonderful people and help preserve their records and memories.
I'm really fascinated, you're talking about these written histories and oral histories. I'm fascinated to know, in your experience, what you're discovering in terms of, the digital age of, both documentation, but also so much of what we do happens online now. And I would love to know how we as a community, but also you as archivists, are able to kind of marry those two worlds together and how they do come together in an archivist sense.
Well, look, that's incredibly fascinating, and it's so much of what I do in a day-to-day business with my work life and with the archives. And increasingly what we're seeing in terms of that kind of digital preservation is that the record is different. It's different from what the record looks like in an earlier period. I think particularly if you're looking at kind of 1970s and 80s activism, when everything was in print, you often have this really keen sense of documenting, say, minuting, doing agendas, sending things out to everybody, multiple, creating multiple copies of things, and everybody has their own personal papers. What I'm seeing more now in terms of a digital context is that there's often not the same sense of record keeping in a documentation, in a note taking and centralized way. Things are distributed. Often in an earlier period, you would have had a secretary who would have kind of kept things together, and you would have had a central record as well. We don't have that now. Things are more distributed. Things are kind of blown out in the context of how we see the networks of activism and how we see that record. So it can be quite hard to document a lot of contemporary activism, and particularly when you're looking at, say, the social activism that happens, in a completely socially networked way. I think it is a really different space, and, we have to change with the time. We have to change our approach, and, we also need to look at the different ways that people are responding to things. Lately I've been looking at how people are responding to COVID, looking at TikTok and looking at, different types of YouTube PSAs and other things, and the ways that we can try and document the way the queer community has responded to things. you know, helping and working with different individuals to do that kind of documentation. But from a community organizing perspective, and particularly from an activist perspective, it does become quite hard, and it becomes different. You need to document things in different ways and also change your standards. You know, if a venue only produces things digitally, you know, what can I do? Can I get a vector file? Can I get, you know, from the designer as opposed to the venue that prints something off? If I'm talking to an activist, you know, what are they documenting? What are they preserving? And, you know, I think in a previous period, people would have letters that they would have sent back and forth, but people are often uncomfortable sending, you know, preserving emails and that sort of correspondence. It's a little bit more informal.
Makes me think of that. I was mentioning before how there'd been the records of a bi plus peer group in the 70s, and how not being able to pay for postage is what kind of drove it down, that they couldn't afford to send out the newsletters because of post expense. And so it was that sense of how, while it's harder to track in some ways, the internet does allow like free communication in ways that can kind of, but also, so it's almost like, should all grassroots orgs send copies of their minutes to ALGA every meeting? Would that be helpful? or would that just be a huge amount of emails to have to sort through?
Oh, look, it's, you know, we have different arrangements with different groups in that sense. And some people do send us stuff on a regular basis. And some people, you know, we get deluges at a certain period of time. You know, many people in Melbourne might be aware of the Also Foundation, which helped support and I guess inspire and spin off numerous organisations in Melbourne. And what I ended up kind of working through their records a couple of years ago, and you know, there was 6 to 8 cubic meters of material, which is quite a bit. Try to visualize.
Trying to.
But it was just dumped in a storage locker, and so you know, there is different, you know, ways of doing things at different points in time. And all I would say, if anybody is out there thinking either about personal or organizational record keeping, you are the best person to organize that, and please have good file structures and naming and dates and all of that thing. And if you want any advice, please contact me.
yeah, we'll be right back letting you know how to have a great filing system. No, we won't be talking about that. No, like after these community messages.
Don't get me started again.
I can't, I'm so uncomfortable. this is Poison Girls with Political Love. You're on Triple Bypass on Joy 94.9. I just need to hose these boys down. Be right back. That was Poison Girls with Political Love. I'm Ruby.
And I'm Alex.
And you're listening to Triple Bypass, home of Joy's bisexual agenda. We've been talking, and Alex has been flirting with Nick Henderson from the Gay and Lesbian Archives, Lesbian and Gay Archives of Australia, ALGA. I got that so mixed up.
It's okay. It's lesbian and gay because gay liberation is based on feminism, and everything is based on the women's movement.
Now I'm going to flirt with you. Be careful. All right. Now... Now, with all the history that
I mean, that's what this show is all about, right?
Definitely. That's why I set it up 4 years ago. I wanted to just flirt with a lot of bisexual people about history. but I think we've been talking a bit about, firstly, how the archives work and how things are being digitized now, but also why it was so important to start recording history for communities that had been criminalized for a long time. There was no records. There was no history. There was no legal way of holding on to what we've done and what we've been through. And with all the history that you've witnessed and all the work you've been doing with ALGA over the years, what have you observed about how the LGBTIQA+ communities have operated? Are there patterns you picked up on? Are there themes that have continued to occur? Are there patterns of destruction we've continued to go down? Are there victories are there ways we've achieved victory over and over again? What have you learned about us and our communities in Australia and how we are?
Well, that's a small question. Look, what
I'm going to finish.
Absolutely. Look, what I would say, and I'd probably bring in, you know, 20 years of many, many, many committees into this, is that, you know, I think often there is this sense of things occurring and in terms of community organisations and falling apart and, you know, issues to do with sustainability and generational change and structures and forms. And I think you know, often what happens is that you get a couple of individuals who often really devote a huge amount of their time to organisations, and it can be quite hard sometimes to broaden out the responsibilities and the workload, and also to go through that kind of generational change from early organisers to moving beyond and creating structures which can sustain into, I guess, an ongoing form. Certainly, you know, the archives, I think, is a great example of an organisation. You know, we've been going for 42 years, so I think that's pretty good in a track record within community. And you know, our trajectory, I think, in many ways also mirrors the sorts of developments within community. And I think, you know, one thing I did want to mention is that we have spent 18 months going through a name change consultation, and if anybody wants to find out a bit more about that and where we're going as an organisation, pop onto our website, which is www.alga.org.au, at least for the moment, and you can find out a little bit more about what we're engaged with in terms of our name and where we're going. I think for a lot of people who engage with community, it's very easy to get burnt out as part of contributing to a committee or contributing as a volunteer. And I think one of the wonderful things about our communities is that we do it ourselves in large part. You know, we don't generally have the government structures, although it's really fantastic the support that we get from the current Victorian government. And look at the Pride Centre and look at the other work that's been done, but is that we do these things for ourselves, and that we can make the world that we want, that we can build that community. And, you know, I think that the efforts, whether or not it was also in past, also Foundation in past years, or looking at the current Pride Centre, we can see the organisations coming together to create a better whole, to create a better community. And, you know, I think it's really wonderful, the amazing individuals who have really contributed so much of their lives to making the community that we want to see. And, you know, thank you to all of those amazing individuals who have made it to be what it is and who have volunteered so many years of their lives to make it in that way. Yeah, look, I'm very grateful to be able to contribute to that.
It is interesting to consider, though, that so much history could be through the eyes of one or two people. As you say, you know, we were talking earlier in the show about so many histories and archives that might have been straightwashed or dumbed down, I guess, for communities who maybe didn't understand or weren't ready to understand. I guess so much control can fall to one or two people who do operate within an organisation to represent their history. Is there any way you can combat that, I guess, or do you just take and take that as, I guess, the broadest history possible?
No, I mean, look, you always need to read against the grain in terms of those histories. You always need to take multiplicities of histories and views when you look at that. There is no singular received history that really can ever account for the diversity of that. One of the great things, I think, about queer history is that we need to rely on oral histories, we need to rely on where we can print histories and other forms. We often need to rely on, you know, tabloid media for earlier periods. If you go back to a pre-gay liberation period, if you're looking at documentary evidence, you will need to look at the newspapers, you will need to look at tabloid, you need to look at court records and police records and all of those things. But you need to be able to construct it by reading against those and constructing those, pulling all those threads together. And if you're looking at it, you need to be able to marshal all of those. There will always be the biases that come from the privilege of often gay white men who have more money to be able to have stable housing, to be able to preserve those records, to be able to pass them on. But there is still a lot of information that you can gain within that. You know, the Lesbian and Gay Archives is formed within a coalitionist activism of the late 1970s, and that was very broad and encompassing. But that doesn't mean in any way that we had all those threads that we could pull together, particularly about non-English-speaking background, multicultural, if you're looking at Indigenous, many different aspects of our community. But we've always been open, and we're always keen to bring all of those threads together. And particularly in terms of, you know, in the current program that we're talking on, talking about bisexual history and, you know, working on those. So, you know, we've done some great work recently digitizing a whole lot of material relating to the newsletters of 90s activist groups and really trying to pull out those threads that we're finding within the archives, that some have been there for a long time, some we're just receiving, and building those networks to ensure that we have that diversity of record, that we can make that available for the community.
Absolutely. And I was thinking about, you know, the name change is obviously a big deal. It is for any organization that goes through some kind of fundamental change to their name. Obviously, it doesn't really change to what you're doing because you're already documenting such a colorful history and such a broad spectrum of the community at the same time. Do you think that a name change will alter the way people approach and work with the archives? Is it going to, I guess, change the way people are contributing to the archives by opening up a name?
Look, I think it will. You know, we didn't do this just for being woke. We didn't do this because we thought, oh, hey, this would be cool on a letterhead. This was because we had our members asking us to. We had members of the public who weren't members of our organization. We had a lot of people talking to us about what our name meant to them and what it, you know, the inhibitions that made them feel about engaging with us. It didn't stop many people from donating material. We have wonderful collections already, but it did mean that there were a number of people who really weren't so keen, who didn't think that it would be something we would want. You know, we want to make everybody feel as though this is their archives within community. Yeah. And I hope that they do feel that that is part of it. You know, if anybody wants to find out more information about what we hold, about their history, whether or not it's bi or trans, intersex or other material, Indigenous, multicultural, we have a huge amount of material in our collection. You know, there's over 600 shelf meters of material. There's vast amounts of digital archives. You know, there is a lot of material here to be able to work through. There is absolutely gaps in the collection, and, you know, we want to work with the community to help build that to ensure that it's preserved for future.
And so how can people go about accessing the archives and looking through the shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves and shelves and cubic meters of data?
Well, in a, you know, COVID socially distanced context, it's a little hard to look through the shelves at the moment. But what I would say is that, you know, look, we have our website, which is currently being redeveloped. Check back in 2 weeks. It'll be pretty exciting. We have our Facebook page. We have a Facebook group, which is a space to share and engage. We try to push some of our content out into a lot of different Facebook spaces, but also Twitter. If anybody's interested in finding out more about the collection, we have different lists online, but there's a lot more that isn't listed. So please send us an email, send us a message on Facebook or Twitter or email, whatever that is, and you can find out more. You're very, very welcome to become a member. It's $20 a year or $5 for low income and unemployed. Or really anybody who's in hardship. So, you know, please consider engaging with the archives. You know, we'd love to be able to tell you more. And if you're looking to research, you're looking to create artworks or podcasts, whatever that is, we're here to support you to do and to engage with that history.
Nick, what would be the one thing you would, if someone was asking, well, why should I want to engage about my history, what would you say has been the biggest benefit for you as a person, not as an archivist, from being involved and from being able to access all of this history?
Oh, look, I think personally, knowing history, knowing about what's come before, whether or not that's something to do with, you know, World War II or, you know, the Great Leap Forward in China or whatever that is in terms of history, helps to understand the social dynamics and politics of your own time. I think understanding the queer history that's gone before in all its messiness and complexity helps you understand more about your own identity and where you've come from. it understands the words and the language that you use. I think often we don't know what's come before. We don't know the kind of roots to those things. And it helps you to question and to engage with the situations that you find yourself in the present. You know, there's so often that we are presented with issues and concepts, and even more so in our, news environment at the moment, which where, you know, you need to constantly question, you know, what you're being presented with. To have that knowledge of history helps you inform your engagement with the present and your, you know, how you see that. And I think it's, you know, there is so much information there and so much wonderful history and diversity and objectness that you can engage with. And
there's a lot to be proud of, isn't there?
There is, and it's exciting and it's beautiful, and it's not boring war history. It's not dates. You know, it's sure, look, there is absolutely dildo mold and leather jackets, but there is so much more than that, and it's pretty exciting.
Well, you can find more about ALGA on their socials. So Facebook is ALGA Archives, so ALGARCHIVES. And on Twitter as ALG Archives. That's all for that. We're wrapping up for an episode of Triple Bypass, but we'll be back again next Tuesday to bring you more of the Bypass agenda. You can find every episode ever as a podcast at joy.org.au/TripleBypass, wherever you get your podcasts. And a big thank you to our podcaster, Lou, who brings you these podcasts every week. And if you know a friend who'd enjoy our show, let them know that's what community all is about. And sharing is super cute. Plus, it's a great time to get them in just before Celebrate Bisexuality Day, a.k.a. Bisexuality Day tomorrow. Ooh. You can follow us on our socials, Facebook, Triple Bypass, Instagram, Triple Bypass Joy, or email us at any time at triplebypass@joy.org.au. I'm Ruby.
And I'm Alex.
And this has been another Bypass takeover from the team at Triple Bypass on John 4.9. Have a great night.